power. Oh, dear. We know where the power is.
Oh, yes, Miss America. Are you on?
I'm on. Oh, yes, I'm on now.
Yeah. You're on.
I know. This is going to seem like much ado about nothing, because all I am doing here right now is to invite you to move into your talking circles, to talk in groups of three. Any questions that you might have about the comments, the insights that Rita shared with us, that you would like to bring to the entire group for a focus wrap-up at the end of this time when we hear the music playing, please bring them to me at the table anytime during your discussion, and we will use those to wrap up this first section. And please enjoy each other's company. Can we invite you back, please, to the plenary session?
If I can't do this way.
Can you hear? Okay.
Yeah. Let us invite us all back to the plenary session. We have a handful of questions. At $1 each, we will address them. The basket will be passed around. We will need jobs after this. We do not have a lot of time to do this, and so what I have proposed is that we read the questions to you that have surfaced. And then out of those questions, Rita and I will have a conversation about perhaps some more questions coming from those questions and some insights. Is suffering that is chosen out of the suffering that is chosen out of a position of strength and love not very different than weak victimization? And is it not different if that love can be affecting a change in the oppressing system from strength?
Oh, yeah. It's not the suffering that's the redemptive. It's not suffering that's redemptive. It's that willingness to take the risk. I don't know anybody who doesn't. Most people I know take enormous risks. Any feminist I know has taken enormous risks. And the point isn't to suffer. The point is to make a change. And the hope is that something will be different. And so you're willing to take the suffering on, not because there's something noble or redemptive about suffering. Suffering is just suffering, and sometimes it's tragic and it destroys people. The point is to make a change, to take a risk.
Not understanding that the crucifixion is abusive, can you further articulate? Yes.
Yeah. The crucifixion per se is not, it's a sign of what an oppressive system can do to someone whose commitments are to justice and to liberation. So the that's what the crucifixion is to me. It's how we interpret the meaning of that crucifixion that can become part of a way an abusive system works. And I think to say that that crucifixion by those powers was somehow necessary for us to be reconciled with God, that is an abusive claim.
And it is particularly insidious when it is taught to people who have no other access to different insights about it. And particularly that can be a class issue, can also be a race issue. There are a variety of issues around it. Could I ask Sue, when it is time for us, would you just play a little and then I will introduce the next person. Thank you. This next question is for the afternoon. How do we continue to develop a strong theology that resists victimhood and yet avoids laying shame on those unable to avoid or pull themselves out of victimhood?
I don't think we do victims much of a favor by putting them on a pedestal. I think that's been part of the problem all along, that there's been this doctrine that Jesus was somehow perfect and innocent, and so he was the least deserving of what happened to him, and he went to his death. And I think that of course, that supposedly he did that for us once and for all, so we don't have to do it, but of course we're also told that he is a model for us and we're supposed to do what he does, so I think there's a massive confusion around that. So what the message the victims get is, you could be like Jesus if you're innocent and good. Otherwise, if you're not innocent and good and you're suffering, then you're not like Jesus, therefore you deserve it. So I don't think we do victims much help if we elevate victimhood to some kind of spiritual status or make it noble. I think it's a fact of life that sometimes we are victimized. What I think is helpful is if we're dealing with oppression and we're dealing with people who feel powerless, the question is not, I think, what can we do for them, but what can we do in solidarity? So in solidarity, you have to ask, what is it that they want, not what we think they need? So I've learned this lesson a lot, and I've been doing research on the sex industry in Asia and the United States for the last 4 years. The average age of entry into the sex industry in the United States is 14 years old. In Asia, it's much younger. So you're talking about children. And part of the way the system works is it makes them helpless, entraps them into an industry, and then makes them feel like there's nothing they can do to get out. People who work in anti-sex industry work in Asian countries and in the United States don't go around deciding what these people need. They ask them, what can we do to help you? What can we do to make your life livable or save your life? And they get different answers. Not everybody has the same thing they need. But I think if you're going to talk about how do we help people who are in systems of victimization, we have to figure out how to discern what power they do have and what help they need from us. And not figure out that we have all the answers and that we're going to go in and fix it. This is the paternalism of power at work.
There was a point at which Arita and I and Bud and Pam had a conversation about Christology. And we had talked about individualized sin, or seeing sin as something privatized and seeing it as something corporate or communal. And what are the kind of things in the Christian tradition, perhaps particularly in the Christian tradition, that we see in terms of privatized sin? And it is generally around issues of sex and sexuality. Sexual behavior, sexual orientation, those kind of things. People who are most often victims, in a variety of ways, are victimized sexually as well. If they see their participation in that as something that is sinful, does that then contribute to their own sense of shame and guilt? What does that say about our Christian theology? And then how can they be redeemed from their unjust situation, not from their sin? So as Mary Potter Ingalls says, can we see that sometimes what we would call sin for someone who is not in a victim state might be something that is saving another person, that is a survival tactic, for instance, disassociation? Can it be a survival tactic for someone who is a victim? What does that say then about an absolute understanding of an individual sin? It says that we need to rethink that piece. Yeah. The next question has to do with how we talk about Jesus as a justice maker. Okay, get ready. And avoid seeing Jesus as nothing more than the perfect moral example.
I think part of the tendency, which is has historical reasons because of the tension between Judaism and Christianity, but the tendency has been to lift Jesus out of his historical cultural context and make him the supreme example of anything we think is good. I think it's very clear that we have to understand that his commitment to justice was a Jewish prophetic commitment, and that his community also had that commitment. And the issue is not, is he an example for us, but does he also in some way empower our own commitment? And his community, do they empower our own commitment? I think it's a trap. It's the same trap, I think, that early on feminists got into in trying to figure out how to use Jesus for women to say, well, Jesus was a feminist. First of all, it's an anachronism. Not even a concept in Jesus' time. That he was kind to women is pretty obvious. But the issue is not so much, was Jesus a feminist? But are we? And that in his time and culture, he was committed to justice in the ways that he understood in his time and culture and place. So our commitment is to justice in our time and culture and place. And some of the things he did aren't very helpful. But that's okay. We like him anyway. He is our brother in this struggle. And that's part of what it means to be friend someone and to be in dialogue with them and to take them seriously is you don't expect them to be perfect. You just expect to be engaged with them and to be committed to their well-being and your own well-being.
You all sound look moved to me. Is the microphone on now? Can you hear it now?
Not loud enough.
Is it? I can hear that it's on. Is that good? Like, all right.
Okay.
All right. Okay. Here we go.
This is a paradigm of women struggling to find our voices.
All right. We are here to respond, and this is. We're going to do this a la Karnak. No. The last time the music started, I was going to respond to a piece of the question around Jesus and the idea of perfection. I think in some ways we set ourselves up for failure when we use that word so freely, as though there is some objective measure of what perfection is, or that Jesus would have had a clue what our objective measure or definition of perfection is about. The attitude toward perfection that we sometimes buy into and get tripped up by is a Greek philosophical idea of perfection, one of which Jesus would have not had an idea. But more than the definition, more than thinking that there is some objective definition of perfection, I like to ask myself, what is the consequence of this particular definition of perfection? Who gains by this definition and who loses? If we come down through history, we will see that women are imperfect males. Male is perfect, women are imperfect. What does that say in terms of if God is perfect and if we are to be perfect as God is perfect, what does that say about the way that we are made up physically as human beings? What if our perfection means that somebody needs to hear with both ears in the way we think is perfect hearing? Or 20/20 vision, or to be mobile in a certain kind of way, and if they are not, that is seen as imperfect. How we view perfection, or even if we ought to keep it in our vocabulary, I question. I question whether it's a word that ought to be used. Is excellence, is integrity, is integration not more important than somebody's subjective definition of perfection? It is somebody's. It's somebody's. It's not objective. So when we say, is Jesus perfect? Are we perfect like Jesus is? According to who? Who gets to present the standard? And what is that standard about? That was just about Jesus and perfection. Rita has a question. What if God is not all-powerful because of our free will? What do we do with free will?
Yeah.
That's yours.
Can you hear me? Is this on?
No.
Something's wrong with this. It's turned on.
Try now.
Now? No. That's the mute.
Okay. Okay.
Is it? No.
Well, you're flashing light, so you're supposed to be on.
My light is flashing, but there's no sound coming out. Is that not enough
the
volume?
Okay. We're very cozy here.
What people will do to get close to Miss America.
Good. Right. Classically, that's been what I think of as a kind of fudge for the omnipotence of God, is to say, well, that God doesn't create evil, it's human free will, and we're given free will by God, and that's what creates evil. And that's been the traditional theodicy, or the way to explain the existence of evil. I think it's highly problematic because it makes free will bad. Because the corollary to that is, if we use our will to be obedient to God, then we are doing what God wants and not acting in a free way, in a sense. I mean, we have to choose that. But I think it puts a connotation on free will that connects it immediately to sin and to things problematic. And I think it's an attempt to defend the omnipotence of God, which is already problematic as a doctrine. The idea of this omnipotent, all-knowing, perfect being that controls everything is a Greek philosophical, it's drawn from Greek philosophical tradition, it's certainly not a biblical idea. So I think that's already problematic, and somebody on another question asked, well, am I not assuming the omnipotence of God in this discussion of atonement? And no, I'm not assuming it, the tradition did, and that's why the doctrine of the atonement got formulated the way it did. I think if we think real carefully about this issue of willfulness, I think we draw different conclusions about the role of willfulness and what love in the universe means. I fundamentally hold to the Christian confession that God is love. To me, that is a central Christian idea. It's not just a Christian idea, but it's a definitive idea in the Christian tradition, and an important one. Because it is love that is life-giving to human beings and to the universe in some sense, at least as we relate to the universe. And love is not about demanding obedience. Love is about nurturing the life and creativity and fullness of being of the other. And Sarah Ruddick, in her book Maternal Thinking, talks about one of the obligations of a loving parent. And I think this is an important understanding of what loving means, is to nurture willfulness. Right? Now, some children don't have to have their willfulness nurtured. And what parents lose their hair over this. But her point is that if a child is perfectly obedient, it is the case that parents always fail at some point. We are not perfect beings, and parents just blow it. And if a child continues to be obedient to a parent who is not being loving, then in some sense that child is willing to betray a relationship of trust to their parent and obey them even when the parent isn't being loving. And she argues that, in fact, if a child trusts a relationship of love with a parent, it will be willfully disobedient when the parent is not being loving. And to be willfully disobedient when the parent is not being loving is a greater act of faithfulness to the parental relationship between the parent and child than if the child is obedient. So there's a paradox about parental power and love being a process of teaching this kind of discernment and willfulness in children so that they can recognize when they are being loved and when they are not being loved. So that our capacity to trust our own feelings, our capacity to be willing to acknowledge when we feel violated or hurt or in some way not loved, is part of our willfulness, is part of our responsibility, really, as human beings, to be discerning and faithful to what we believe love to be. That doesn't make us perfect, that doesn't always make us right, but willfulness is crucial. And when we say free will, our exercise of willfulness, is what creates evil, then I think we create a fundamental problem with our capacity for willfulness, which is crucial to our ability to be in the world in loving relationships. If we cannot discern for ourselves what is loving and what is not loving, and we are simply obedient to a tradition, to authority, to parent, to anybody who's in a position to have power over us, then I think we create a system of obedience and punishment rather than love and faithfulness. And I think we saw that clearly in Nazi Germany, what obedience does. Being obedient, teaching obedience rather than discernment and willfulness.
I think another piece of that is, does everyone come to a choice with an equal amount of freedom? That sometimes is an assumption that is made, that we have an equal amount of freedom, that we are equally free from oppressions or free from influences that would cause us to decide one way or another. What do we mean by free? What are the parameters of that? Is someone of the people that Rita was talking about this morning in the sex trade, when they go into it at 8 or 9 years old, a system of oppression, sexism and racism and classism and all of that, is that person as accountable for some of the choices they make in their life as I might be at this particular moment in my life? So how we talk about free also deserves as much examination, I believe, as what is perfect
or willful.
Right.
Okay. And then I have a question here. If I come to people any way they can see me, if this is God, then must we accept any view of God as equally valid? Must views of God be tied to justice to be valid? The first question, no. The second question, yes. that justice is love made social. Justice is love beyond the bounds of interpersonal and intrapersonal relationships. It is the social dimension of life where we are held accountable for how we participate in larger systems. And in some sense, every one of us in this room lives an unjust life, because the lifestyle that we live is lived off the backs of people in the two-thirds world. We consume way more than our fair share of the Earth's resources, and we pollute way more than we ought to do for the survival of our species on this planet. And so we have to be concerned about justice, and I think that if we say we believe in a loving and caring God and we do not serve justice, then I think we betray our faith in that God. It's like a rabbi once said to me, was preaching a sermon, and he was asking his congregation, there's the Exodus line about you will not live a falsehood. And he said, you know, he asked his congregation, what does that mean? And they all thought it meant you shouldn't lie, which is a very personal, isolated understanding of it. And he said, oh, that's much too literal. the point of that text is, if you believe in a God of justice and you live in an unjust society and do nothing, then you live in a falsehood. So that, yes, for me, the concept where I see God in the world is deeply tied to justice. But it isn't just justice, which is why we talk about wholeness and healing. The work of the Spirit in our lives can also be quite personal and quite intimate. And that those are also dimensions of where we recognize the mystery and presence of God in our lives. But if those relationships are somehow isolated and separated from the larger concern for justice, then I think there is a falsehood there. If we care about a friend in a battering relationship, we are obligated in some sense to do something for justice, however that friend asks us to help, and in ways that are within the limits of our own conscience to act. Sometimes people ask us to do things we can't do. So I don't think the question is should we just accept God in any old form as anybody presents God to us, but to ask discerning and faithful questions about how is this relating to my life and how am I relating to this person or this system and where do I see this presence of love and mystery and healing and wholeness and justice. That those are the questions. And we don't just accept, we have to think through, we have to chew on, we have to integrate. We're not passive recipients of revelation. Revelation never works that way.
Four questions that I use around this topic. When a presentation of God is given, the questions I ask are, who has the most to gain from this understanding? Who has the most to lose from this understanding? Who is included in this understanding of God? And who is excluded? Those have been very helpful discerning questions for me, and I think follow from what you have said about we do not give up our discernment in order to understand God.
And I think the theological task, one more line, the theological task is not for all of us definitively to settle on an idea of Jesus or God that we can all agree to, but for each of us to bring our own lives into the discussion and to take seriously the lives of others and to be in an engaged dialogical process of discerning and at this moment in our lives what is for us the meaning of those words. Certainly my understanding of those words have changed drastically over my lifetime, and I don't expect them to stay the same as they are today because I see theology as a kind of dialogical process of constant searching and discernment, not creating a reified form over here that now I suddenly have figured it all out and I will just obey this.